From West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Support for the legislature today is provided by AARP West Virginia, your ally for real possibilities in the Mountain State. Learn more at aarp.org/WV. The Charleston Gazette-Mail, using its CGM app to deliver the latest news, traffic, and weather alerts, keeping you in the know while you're on the go. Lumos Networks, online at lumosnetworks.com. Marshall University, with more than 100 degree programs offered in 4 locations and online. More about the Marshall family at marshall.edu. Orion Strategies, professional public relations, government affairs, creative services, and research and polling, with offices in Charleston, Buchanan, Martinsburg, Pittsburgh, and Columbus.
Good evening and welcome to the Legislature Today from the State Capitol Building. Tonight, a discussion with State House reporters on the activity here this week. But first, for any of us, the first day on a job often comes with a range of emotions and expectations. But as reporter Randy Yowie found out, if you're sent to the State House representing thousands, responsibility weighs heavily. Randy caught up with a diverse group of first-time lawmakers.
I got lost twice. I parked in the wrong parking spot.
I'm feeling a little bit of everything right now. I'm really excited. I'm a little bit nervous.
I'm excited, but I'm nervous too.
So far, having a good time.
Everyone is so welcoming.
I have a lot to learn and I'm really anxious.
Huntington delegate John Matt Jr. began working in his family business at age 13. Now, Matt Stewart's Hot Dogs is a fifth generation family franchise. So this father of six comes to the State House to help businesses small and big grow and prosper through dedicated tax reform.
We're eliminating the inventory tax on business, which is I think very healthy and will bring people in here to open up and provide jobs. Second, we have income tax on Social Security, which hurts a lot of people. I think there's no reason to get taxed twice on that. Another thing, our broadband issue is extremely important here in our state of West Virginia for jobs, for education, and so forth.
Just 31 years old and looking much younger, Delegate Cody Thompson is on leave right now from Elkins High School, where he teaches civics. Fresh off the front lines of the West Virginia teacher strike, Thompson says progress and prosperity will not come to his rural district without rapid broadband expansion.
The fact of the matter is we have students, we have small businesses, and we have a growing massive need for fiber optic lines and high-speed internet access, and we don't have that. And that's what I'm hearing a lot when I'm talking to constituents, when I'm talking to the county developers. They said we need high-speed internet access, Cody. That's to be a nonpartisan issue, whether you're Democrat or Republican. We need high-speed internet access. And so that's one of the major things I want to focus on.
From youth to experience, meet retired Air Force pilot Tom Bibby. He flew the last troops out of Vietnam and served in the Pentagon after 9/11. Now the new Eastern Panhandle delegate and spare time substitute teacher wants to help local West Virginia school systems fly on their own power.
I can see the frustration with a lot of teachers from the standpoint of needing local control of the curriculum, what they can and what they can't do. Control over discipline, because discipline in the schools is not what it was when you and I were back in school.
Mother Earth and its people make up Delegate Evan Hansen's classroom. The environmental scientist from Morgantown says his bill, changing state code to increase corporate renewable energy projects, highlights solar power and aligns economic development with environmental protection.
My bill opens up opportunities for providing solar electricity to corporations that want it. There's no new taxes, there's no mandates. And it does it in a very limited way. It says that if you build a large solar array on a former mine land, then you're able to wheel that power to where it needs to go. So in addition to helping to protect jobs and create new jobs, it's actually going to help us find some productive use of these formerly mined lands.
an environmental scientist, a high school civics teacher, a retired Air Force pilot, a hot dog magnet? Are we seeing a trend away from a lawyer-laden legislature?
Well, I am an attorney. I think
new Senator Richard Lindsay hails from Charleston. You know. But the respected lawyer's concerns extend to all Mountain State families. Lindsay's bill would have West Virginia hopefully enhancing lives and development by enacting a true family paid leave statute.
There are about seven or eight states in the country that allow folks to take upwards of 12 weeks away from the work, still get paid 2/3 of their paycheck, keep their job, and be able to take care of either a sick child or a sick parent. I think that type of program brings stability in the home and allows folks to live the lives that they should.
Senator William Ehlenfeld's Northern Panhandle background highlights more than 20 years as a federal prosecutor and United States District Attorney. The new Senate member plans to take his criminal fight against the opioid crisis and private and government corruption to the legislative level.
I helped investigate the West Virginia Division of Highways when I was the U.S. Attorney. We returned multiple indictments against people who were engaged in political activity on state time, who were engaged in bid rigging and other types of illegal activity. And so that is near and dear to my heart, is addressing those kinds of issues. Corruption, unfortunately, has continued on in state government.
New legislators with diverse agendas, but a common cause, a better West Virginia. For the legislature today, I'm Randy Yowie at the Capitol.
Joining me now are veteran State House reporters Phil Kapler of the Charleston Gazette-Mail and Brad McElhaney of West Virginia Metro News. Thank you both for joining us tonight. I want to go through some of the initiatives that were brought out in the governor's State of the State address, but first I want to link to the story that Randy just brought us, and that was a feature of, I believe, a half a dozen new lawmakers. There are, 36 new members in the House alone? Let's just begin with talking, how does so many freshmen, how does that impact the process? So many newcomers.
But I can't remember a case where we've had this many new freshmen, and they don't necessarily ask for my advice, but I always say the first year, listen and learn, and try to learn the rules of order and the procedures, and it's a unique learning curve.
But
it is a unique process. So it's the first year is for most new members is a real learning curve. So it'll be interesting to watch these new members kind of mature and learn
and make their way.
Right,
Brad.
You know that trend appeared to begin last session when there was, for whatever reason, a lot of turnover in the House. In some cases, the governor was plucking delegates to go fill vacancies in the Senate, and then there were some other reasons that people began to turn over in those roles. But it's a challenge for people like us to figure out, you know, first of all, who we're looking at and get our bearings. And it's a bit of a different makeup, too. There's been, frankly, more women who have mm-hmm. taken office, particularly in the House of Delegates, particularly on the Democratic side. And so we'll see if that changes the tone of some of this debate.
And I think what I want to get to is the power structure and committee chairmanships and vice chairmanships, lots of different people taking those places. I mean, who got what and why? What do we know? In the more powerful, the more prestigious, more sought after roles of judiciary, education, finance, those bigger committees.
Right. Yeah, we have, a lot of leadership changes, and of course we have a new speaker, which is always usually a rough transition, because I always say it's like being in a car. You can ride in a car for years, and then the first time you have to drive, it's difficult to be up there on that podium and leading the floor sessions. But so far, Speaker Hanshaw is doing it like he's been a professional for years and years. And some of the other committee chairs, I personally haven't had an opportunity to see them in action yet, so I'm looking forward to that as as we get into the second week of the session.
Henshaw, the new House Speaker, is not only a lawyer, but also has his chemistry degree, and more than that, is a parliamentarian. He's got parliamentary training. So he's got three things going for him as he takes that gavel. But yeah, because he has assumed leadership of the House, he has placed new people in a lot of these committees. The Finance Committee chairman is new, had mm-hmm. been the vice chairman previously. And in the House and the Senate, there are new chair people of the education committees coming off of that statewide teacher strike last year, with talk of a lot of education bills, including potentially controversial bills like charter schools, coming through each of those committees. So those folks could be on the hot seat. Those are Danny Hamrick, the House Education Chairman, and Patricia Rucker, the Senate Education Chairwoman.
And can we just acknowledge how powerful the chairman are, the leadership? I mean, really, a handful of people really guide things through each of the houses.
Yeah, out of each house, you probably have 12 or 14 people who actually run the show. And I think with education in the Senate, with Patricia Rucker, that's going to be very interesting because the teachers unions are not particularly enthused that she's been an advocate of charter schools and homeschooling, so they see her as something of a threat to what was accomplished last year during the walkout. So that's going to be very interesting to see how she maneuvers dealing with the representatives of the teachers' unions.
In fact, Mr. Daley, head of WVEA, said it was an affront. On the part of the Senate President to place Senator Rucker in that position. It started off right away.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting chess game because I think President Carmichael will be up for re-election in 2020, and I think he suspects he'll be targeted by the teachers' unions as some of the other leadership was in the last election. So I don't know if this is to send a message to the teachers or not, but it's definitely moving the pieces on the chessboard around.
Well, let's go on and move to the state of the state. It was only 2 days ago. Seems like maybe a week, but it was just 2 days ago, less than 48
hours ago.
Have we figured
out everything that was said yet?
What are you hearing just generally? What have people's impressions here, especially here at the Capitol, about the governor's speech overall?
You know, we wound up in the same Senate finance meeting right. just yesterday, and there were a lot of questions about just the mathematics of mm-hmm. how do these spending endeavors add up versus the tax cuts that the governor wants to do, and where really are we on the budget, and is the relatively healthy financial status of the state right now going to last as some of these gas pipelines reach conclusions, as the coal industry maybe ebbs and flows a bit more. So those are the kinds of questions right now. Will the governor's priorities make it through potential stormy weather ahead?
Well, you know, Phil, Secretary of Revenue Dave Hardy has said it's a very conservative budget for next year.
Yes, I think they've built in just over 2% revenue growth, which is very conservative, and then 1.73% increase in spending. But again, some of the members in Senate Finance raises the question that we've seen peaks and valleys with having a economy based on extractive industries. So we're in a peak right now, but as it's been pointed out, a lot of that is due to the natural gas pipeline construction, which is almost $4 billion worth of investment in 2 years. And that should wrap up at the end of this year. And that takes that money and nearly 14,000 jobs away. So I think a lot of what we heard in finance yesterday was a lot of concern. Do we commit all this money in good times, knowing that inevitably there's going to be a valley at some point, whether it's next year or 2 years beyond or in the sixth year of the six-year forecast? So.
And in that looking down the road and committing, it's unclear that the governor's centerpiece initiative, Jim's Dream, which is his substance abuse program, his focus on blending prevention and treatment, and then the really important piece of recovery and employment. It's been questioned that $25 million, it's coming this first year from the surplus money, but is that
like
a one-time 25
looks like
looking down?
It's a combination of one-time surplus and then money in the base budget, and they had questions yesterday in Senate Finance, is that an ongoing expense? And I think there's really a lot of, I don't want to say confusion, but it's like a lot of proposals that Jim Justice put out in the past, that he gives the big picture idea first, puts out the big proposal, and then leaves it up to his people to fill in the details as the session goes on. So I think there was a lot of questions like, well, in concept, this seems like a good idea, but how exactly does it work, and where exactly is all this money going? So I think that'll occupy a lot of the remainder of the session, trying to figure out exactly how to take this big idea and put it in a workable piece of legislation.
There was some inadvertent humor that came out of committee meeting too, with people saying, what is Jim's dream? How are we going to pay for Jim's dream? What's included here in the dream? And we don't quite know that yet. The governor had a press conference yesterday to talk about, to expand a bit on the idea, and as you described, it's multifaceted. It's workforce training, it's recovery efforts. There appears to be an early educational component to it, but I don't know that we've seen anything in paper to say, this is how it's gonna work, these are the dollars involved, and here's who's gonna be affected, and what existing programs may be involved.
Yeah, and it's still not clear to me why we need a new program, as opposed to there are existing programs out there, many of them that have been begging for adequate funding. So why create this new umbrella program when it may make sense to fund these existing programs at a greater level? But so there's a lot to be worked out here during the session.
And beyond what the governor has mentioned in his speech this week, what bills, what issues, what topics do you think are going to garner the big attention, emotion this session coming up?
You know, certainly the various tax cut issues, the cutting of the Social Security tax, which we learned this week is maybe not as broad as we had thought.
Something like $50 million is what they're saying now.
Exactly, $50 million, and maybe not all those who receive Social Security are not even paying taxes to begin with. But then the issue of the business and inventory tax, which would be about $140 million each year and also involves constitutional issues, I think is going to continue to be controversial, and we'll see how legislators handle the details of it, or whether they even really move forward with it.
Mm-hmm. And I think, what do you think,
on a completely different issue, I think we're going to see a lot of talk about marijuana, both the medicinal marijuana bill that was passed 2 years ago and goes into effect July 1st, but with no component for banking the revenue that these facilities will produce, since federal law, FDIC banks are prohibited from handling this money. So they've got to work out the financial component on medical marijuana. And now there's talk, particularly among House Democrats, that they would like to take the next step, seeing that other states are doing it and that we want to get in on this bandwagon, to do recreational marijuana, which of course Justice in his State of the State said absolutely not, etched in stone. He supports the banking rules for the medicinal marijuana, but is adamantly opposed to pursuing recreational. So I think that'll be subject of pretty significant discussion this session.
And the Attorney General kickstarted that discussion today with an advisory opinion about how West Virginia's law may interplay with federal law The worry is that people may be prosecuted with the handling of the money. The opinion essentially said there's a range of things you can do, but West Virginia is at risk until federal law is changed. So depending on the risk that people want to assume, that's something they're going to have to measure.
Now, we only have a couple minutes left. It was only at the beginning of this week that the governor announced he would his bid for re-election. How do you think, if in any way, that might frame the activity, the tone here over the next 60 days?
Well, I think we saw a lot of it in the State of the State, where if you remember, his first two State of the State addresses were these really wild affairs. He was not at a podium, but seated on the House floor and had whiteboards and various props. And last year he brought in his girls' high school basketball team to cheer him on. And this year was much more subdued, much more gubernatorial. He entered through the main entrance to the House chambers, where in the past years he's come in through one of the side entrances. He was at the podium. He did some ad-libbing, but not nearly as much as he's done in the past. So I think that was a deliberate effort to look more gubernatorial going into 2020.
And as of today, you've got Joe Manchin, a former governor, saying things like West Virginia needs a full-time governor, a symbolic shot across the bow.
Very good. We're going to have to leave it there. Gentlemen, thank you so much. Phil Kabler of the Charleston Gazette Mail, and Brad McElhenney of West Virginia Metro News. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Next, we continue our journalist perspective with PolitiFact. This is a nonprofit, nonpartisan news outlet that's been fact-checking politicians. Editor Lou Jacobson had his staff look at the governor's State of the State address, and he talked about that with West Virginia Public Broadcasting's news director, Jesse Wright.
So Governor Jim Justice gave his State of the State address on Wednesday night, and you guys went right to work on that. What kinds of things did you look at? What's your approach to fact-checking his speech?
Sure. So, I mean, a lot of the things he said are things he wanted to do, and that's not checkable. But we found maybe about 10 claims which would be checkable and which would be grist for what we would do. About five of them we came up with that we had done something on it in the previous semester, and so we had kind of stuff at our fingertips to do quickly, or stuff that was fairly easy, straightforward to check that night. So we did a five-part wrap-up piece where we checked five of his statements in the speech. Didn't give a formal rating as we would normally do with the editors, kind of, you know, deciding amongst themselves, but just sort of giving some context and saying this sounds more or less accurate, or we checked a similar claim that we gave a mostly true to. And so we did that, and that ran within about an hour and a half of when he finished his speech. And then we also got probably a half dozen other claims that he talked about in his speech, which we can check in the coming days and weeks.
So just in a general sense, how do you think he did in terms of the checkable claims that he made?
It was definitely a mixed bag. Probably the biggest difficulties we found. One was he started off his speech saying that when he was sworn in, the state was bankrupt. And we had actually looked at that last year because he'd said it earlier in his tenure as well. And we found that the term bankrupt really doesn't apply to a state situation like that. Clearly, the state was fiscally stressed at that point, a big shortfall. But to say bankrupt is a little bit of an exaggeration. And so we gave that a pretty skeptical write-up in our piece. And the other thing he said that the Greenbrier County 12th grade graduation rate was 100%. I checked in with his office, and they didn't get back to me. If there's any further evidence we get on that, we can certainly change that. But we looked up on the database, which is just very straightforward to find online, and it was in the high 80s or the low 90s. It was not 100%. So I'm not sure exactly where he got that from.
So beyond the governor, you're going to be looking at maybe Senate, House leaders, those types of folks, maybe floor speeches. Mm-hmm. That's sort of par for the course, so that's what our audience can expect as we republish and take a look at your work. Anything else that you'll be looking at in terms of your relationship in West Virginia and what you'll be doing in the state going forward?
Well, we certainly pay a lot of attention to the members of Congress, it may be a case where they speak about a national issue, but they're a West Virginia representative, and so we're trying to hold them accountable for that reason. So that's a bit different than a person saying something about West Virginia substantively that we check. It'll be nice if President Trump comes back because those are always great things to fact check. We come up with probably 15 items to fact check him on whenever he does a live rally here. So we'll just keep our eye out. We'd like to do more of the live fact checks, it just sort of depends on finding the right sort of event.
Next week, we're scheduled to talk with the governor, Senate president, and House speaker, and we'll dive deeper into the budget. I'm Suzanne Higgins. For everyone here at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great weekend.